I would like to welcome everyone to a few things. First of all, Tazria Mitzora is our parsha, our double parsha for this week. And welcome back after our Pesach hiatus. The last class we had was on Parshas Vayikra. So we, unfortunately, this time around, we missed out on Tzav and Shemini. And now we're up to Tazria Mitzora. We will be reading three double parshas in close succession over the next month. We have Tazria Mitzora this week, Acharei Mos Kedoshim next week, and then we have a single, Emor, and then back to a double, the Har B'chukosai.
The double next week, right?
Double next week, yeah. So it's like, you know, Lahavdil in the baseball season, you know, you have some double headers, you have some single games. So we have a busy season coming up ahead of us.
Does that mean much more is going to go into overtime?
Yes, it means actually twice as much.
Extra innings is the correct.
Well, same thing, overtime.
All right. But because it is right after Pesach, I was inspired by some discussions that I had with family members over Pesach to have some thoughts which I would like to share but incorporate with our Parsha. And of course we also have to do justice to Mesilas Yesharim because this is our companion for the year.
You have interest in the company.
So what I'd like to do today is present. I've tried very very hard to organize my thoughts so that it flows. I'd like to mention something about the Parsha and then share with you my Pesach thoughts while incorporating Mesilas Yesharim and then return back to where we started with the Parsha. Now Tazria Mitzora at first glance is an impossible Parsha to discuss unless you are a dermatologist or an environmental specialist or something like that, because it's all about these strange afflictions that visit a person's body or hair or skin, or even more, it can visit his clothing or furniture. And the next Parsha Mitzora, it can appear on the walls of his house, and it is very difficult to understand, and certainly all of the technicalities which are discussed in the Parsha, it makes a person just cringe. It is so difficult to understand the Parsha. So just a simple reading of it is very, very difficult. What's very often done with this Parsha is to discuss what the sages teach is the leading cause for a person to receive these afflictions, known as Saras, and that is the leading cause, not the only cause, but the leading cause is habitual speaking of Lashon Hara. Maligning others, speaking of people's faults, even if they are maybe founded and true, but speaking of them to others is considered to be a very, very serious offense, transgression. And very often people turn their attention and their discussion during these parshios to Lashon Hara. And we certainly have done some of that in previous years. I'd like to take another little angle and rather focus on the three targets of the Tzaras, the body, the clothing, and the house, because that is something that we can discuss in a relevant way. Why does a person receive Tzaras on these areas? Now Rambam, he says, and this is pretty well known, that it's just a progression. In fact, he says that the first place Tzaras would appear would be the house as a warning. Jew, improve yourself, stop speaking Lashon Hara or whatever your sin is. And if you don't, it's going to move closer to you. It's like the story with the viper, you know. I'm on the I'm on the first floor, I'm on the fifth floor. You know the joke with the viper? Oh, I grew up with it as a kid. I assume it predated me by a lot. You know the joke? A guy gets a telephone call. He lives in a high riser on the 20th floor. Hello? This is the viper. He hangs up the phone. Oh, no. Oh, he says, this is the viper. I'm on the ground floor. Click. He says, uh-oh. And he gets another phone call. This is the viper. I'm on the fifth floor. And I'm going higher. Ah! You know, it keeps on getting higher and closer and closer. Finally, he's knocking on the door. Who is it? I am the viper. The window viper. I've come to wipe your windows.
Yeah.
You don't know that joke?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's your radio program.
It's as old as the hills. All right. Anyway, so the Rambam says that's what the warning of the Taras is. First it comes to the house. If you don't improve, then it comes to the clothes. And if you still don't improve, then it comes to your person. That's how the Rambam relates to that. I have no doubt that is true. But that's not the way it's presented in the Torah. It's the body first, then the clothing, then the house. I remember just very, very vaguely hearing one time that the reason why the tzaras can strike the person or the clothing or the house is because there may be a deficiency in the way that the individual uses his body or his clothing or his house. That's all I remember. I don't remember more than that. But the reason why it's targeting these three areas is because these are three areas where a person might be deficient in some way, morally, ethically, and I'd like to try to revisit that approach, and through our other discussion about Pesach and Mesilas Yesharim, perhaps try to shed some light on this notion of the body, the clothing, and the house. And that's certainly something that sounds relevant to us. So let's put that on hold. I know I very often say, let's put that on hold, and let's talk about something else. But God willing, we will come back to it. Okay, so Pesach. What did I learn this year during Pesach? I learned that it's very expensive. This was our first Pesach that we stayed in at home.
It always costs more when
you're at home.
Do it.
I think that the reason in Yiddish, for Yiddish speakers, it's called Pesach because you have to pay asach geld.
Very good.
Pay a lot of money. All right. Let me throw out what could be regarded as a paradox. Pesach paradox. We all know that the theme of Pesach is freedom. The Hebrew word chayrus. In the prayers, whenever we say Chag HaMatzos, the holiday of the Matzos, we say Zman Cheruseinu. It is the time of our freedom, of our liberation. And everybody loves the sound of that. Because it sounds so much like independence and emancipation and freedom from slavery. And when we celebrate our freedom, so then we hold hands with all of the other persecuted nations and minorities, and we feel the solidarity. And who knows? It turns into a universal holiday, which may be okay, but it's certainly not what Pesach is all about. When we were freed from Mitzrayim, what happened was very simple. We went out of Egypt. We gathered in the desert. we were led 7 weeks to the mountain, and there we were. The mountain was held over our heads, including the famous midrash, and said, "Accept the Torah, or this is your end." And we know that once we became the Jewish people, we had more responsibilities, more duties, and a heavier yoke of servitude, albeit to God, than we ever had before. Judaism is anything but liberation and emancipation. Mm. Now, it may be a good type of servitude. We certainly believe that being servants to God beats being a servant to Pharaoh, and God is benevolent, and He is leading us to a destiny of goodness and of ultimate peace and reward. But why do we have to call it the time of our freedom when it's really not freedom? It's freedom from one thing, but it's servitude to another. I have a hard time understanding why the term freedom is associated with Pesach. I mean, I understand it on one level, but if we can throw away our universal associations with that term and realize that, come on, we became a nation enslaved to God, and we now have responsibilities. I'm not so sure. It doesn't seem so obvious to me why this should be called freedom. That's my paradox.
What do you mean by universality?
Because so many people, Jews included, they just focus on the fact that we were slaves and then we were let free. And then they say it's the same thing as the blacks. And it's the same thing as the other minorities. We want to fight for their freedom, just like we experienced freedom, just like we the Jews were persecuted, and then thank God we were liberated. You know, we want these other people to be free too from their persecution. And to us it just becomes a universal message of freedom from oppression. And that's not what Judaism is all about. It's not about freedom from oppression. The freedom from oppression enabled us to become servants to God. But Judaism is about servitude, not about freedom. Not about do what you want. Anybody who knows about the Torah realizes that Jews are not anything but free to do as they please. So to me, that's my Pesach paradox. Why, if going out of Egypt meant accepting the yoke. We call it the yoke of heaven. We call it the yoke of heaven. Yoke means you are a burden by a responsibility, by a heavy load. Look at all the religious obligations just associated with Pesach. You know, you try to tell the housewife that this is a time of freedom, and she'll look at you like you're nuts, like you're mocking her. So, paradox. If Pesach is a time when we accepted the yoke of servitude to God, why is it called the holiday of freedom? That is my Pesach paradox, and I will take a few comments at this moment.
One difference is that we have the choice to accept that yoke or not. We still do. Whereas in Egypt, we haven't. I mean.
So we're celebrating the fact that we can say to God, no, thank you, God. I don't feel like accepting this yoke. And we're celebrating that freedom to say no? Doesn't sound convincing, right?
Well, I was going to suggest this. The word chayrus might mean freedom, it may not. There's another word, chofesh.
Right.
Chofesh means
vacation.
Freedom, which is almost anarchy.
Yeah.
You know, and to have freedom without some sort of constraint is anarchy.
Okay.
So that may help resolve the paradox.
So chayrus is freedom with restraint. It's not unbridled.
With order.
Freedom with order.
You got to belong to something.
Okay.
And the yoke of, you know, being a servant of God, Eved Elohim, if you will, then that's what avodah is, prayer, I guess. Yeah.
Even in Hatikva, we're Am Chofshi because you've come there to a place where you're not around all the
persecutors.
Yeah.
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 But then it's a slippery slope.
Slippery slope.
Because how much chofshi, how much order, how much, you know, and is that what God had in mind, that we should feel more basically freedom with some order? I mean, Judaism, if you look at all of the yoke, it's very little freedom, actually. Very little freedom. A lot more yoke than freedom. A lot more yolk than white.
Oh, what a yolk.
What a yolk.
Yolk's
on me.
Yeah.
All right. I believe, ladies and gentlemen, who attend this class on the Mesilas Yesharim are holding the answer. And I'll bet you it's an answer in a way that you never thought. But I think it's right in front of us. What does this book teach us? And indeed, this is the book of the book of the Torah. Really, this is the deeper explanation of what the Torah is all about. Incidentally, there is a book out, authored, edited by Dr. Avraham Tversky. It's called Lights Along the Way, and it is his editorial comments on the on this book, and he adds, you know, his wonderful insight on contemporary life with his background as a psychiatrist, as a Hasidic rabbi, as a Jewish leader for decades, and it is a wonderful companion to this sefer. And this week I study that book with somebody once a week, and this week we took a look at the biographical notes on Rabbi Luzzatto, and it's fascinating. If you have the book, take a look at the biographical notes, when he lived and in what historical context. I don't know if you're familiar with the story of the Shabtai Tzvi. This was in the late 1600s. There was a lot of persecution. And the Jews were desperate, and they said, the Mashiach has to come now, or we're finished. And along came this man, Shabtai Tzvi, who many, even rabbis, believed was Mashiach. And in the end, after leading them, he converted to Islam. Anyway, I don't know, it doesn't go into detail about that period of time. I'm sure the historians do. Probably Rabbi Wein is prolific on that. In the wake of that, Rabbi Luzzatto was born, and he was an unparalleled thinker, writer, Kabbalist at a very, very young age, and he started writing and teaching, and he had a group of followers that he used to teach Kabbalah to, and they, in fact, took it upon themselves to form a society of very righteous and pious people who would try, through their deeds, to make the world worthy of Mashiach in a real sense. But people heard about this and said, uh-oh, another Shabtai Tzvi. And because of that, he was ultimately, his writings were burned and he was banished. And it's read the story. He ended up, he's from Italy. He ran away in exile to Amsterdam, and apparently the rabbis at the time, they didn't outright ostracize him, but they said, you cannot teach Kabbalah unless you move to Israel and you're at least 40 years old. And sure enough, he was waiting for that day, and he moved to Israel shortly before his 40th birthday. And at that time he was going to start really disseminating, and who knows what would have happened. And right before his 40th birthday, he and his family contracted a disease and died.
Did what? Contracted what?
A disease. And died.
What kind of
typhus disease? Or something. I don't know what it was.
Mm.
So we lost him. And this was one of his works. But the Rambam, the Vilna Gaon, the Gaon of Vilna, who lived maybe a half a century later, and the Vilna Gaon was unparalleled in his scholarship, said that he would have walked through Europe to sit at the feet of Rabbi Luzzatto. That's what he is reported to have said. So when we're reading words of Rabbi Luzzatto, and I'm not just saying this, this is very well known throughout the Torah world. Every yeshiva embraces this as the number one work on Jewish ethics and Musar and all that. Rabbi Luzzatto bases his book on a statement from the Talmud that we have quoted many times. Rabbi Pinchas is on page 6. Page 6. And you'll recognize it right away. Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair said, Torah brings one to vigilance. Vigilance brings one to? Zehirut is vigilance. Zehirut leads to zrizus, alacrity. Alacrity brings to? We skip one. Cleanliness. Nikius. Cleanliness brings to parishus. And onward. What is being said here? Torah makes you into a certain kind of person. It gives you qualities. Interesting. Torah in itself is a yoke. It is duty. It is obligation. But it empowers you. It empowers you to vigilance. Let's take vigilance, for example. What is the definition of vigilance? It's... it is the ability to overcome the natural instinct that all people have to basically act without thinking. We've talked about this many times. The instinct of a person is to get up and do the same thing that he did yesterday, good or not good. Let's take, for example, you have a guy, and for the last 20, 30 years, he wakes up and he's grumpy. And he snaps at his wife, and he yells at his kids, and he goes into work, and he snaps at the people that are under him, and he's just not nice person. And he's not particularly religious. He says he never was, he never will be, and he eats whatever he wants to eat. And you know, the thought of ever changing is the furthest thing from his mind. You know why? Because he never thought about it. He never thought about it. Nobody ever said to him, hey Joe, Yanko, why do you do that? Why do you talk that way to your wife? And maybe she did, but people by nature just don't think. They act without thinking. Vigilance is a skill, and it's a power to stop and to think. Is this the right thing to do? Where am I going? What is the purpose of life? What, according to Rabbi Pinchas, what gives the person that power? How can a person find that power? Look inside chapter 5, where he says that God provided some tool that will give you that power, and that tool is the Torah. And he says there's no other tool, because what's causing this instinct is something that God created within us called the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. The inclination to just rush through life headlong, not thinking. That's the evil inclination, and the only thing that's going to stop it is Torah study and Torah observance. But the result will be the ability to stop and actually decide what it is that you want to do. What do you call that? What's another name for that power?
Intelligence.
I'll repeat. The power to stop acting by instinct and thinking and deciding what you want to do.
Judgment.
Could be a Freudian. You could say it's a superego, but we don't want to go there.
Well, it sounds like it's a human being as opposed to an animal.
Yeah. What does he have? The ability to choose what he is going to do, how he's going to react, how he's going to live. Freedom. Thank you.
Oh, very good. Hey.
Shkoyach. Do you realize that the person before he had that power was not free? He was literally not free. He was enslaved to his instinct. He was enslaved to his habit. He was enslaved to his animalistic drive, just to rush and rush and don't think. Torah teaches a person to be a zahir, to think, and to be able to stop being pushed by your instinct and to make choices. That is freedom. And read through the book. The next step is alacrity. Alacrity is the ability to pick oneself up over his inertia, over his laziness, and overcome his fears, which holds him back from doing things positive. In other words, the hirus is to enable a person to restrain himself from doing bad, wrong, and alacrity's rizus is the ability to overcome one's lethargy and go and do right. Imagine a person can't get up in the morning. He can't go to shul because he just can't get himself out of bed. Or he can't get himself to part with his money and give tzedakah. Or he can't get himself to go lend a hand to the needy, to people that could benefit from his counsel or from his experience. He just can't get himself to do it because he's got to, you know, sit at home on his couch and he's got to watch his programs or whatever it may be. He can't overcome. Well, Torah brings one to vigilance, and vigilance brings one to alacrity, and all of a sudden with alacrity he can pick himself up. He can get out of that easy chair. He can overcome the lethargy. He can now do things that he couldn't do before. That person is free. And the more you develop these qualities in this book, the freer you become. So I believe that the answer to our paradox requires us to just identify, when does the freedom begin? The freedom after the Exodus. You see, I believe that we're all assuming that the time of our freedom, it's immediate. We want to be free now. As soon as Pharaoh lets us go out of the border gates, we are free. No, that's not what it means. We're not free because we still haven't changed. We're still the same people who we are. The rabbis talk about the slaves and how they had a slave mentality and how they really weren't able to change as try as they would. They really couldn't change, and that's why, you know, the first generation didn't make it to the promised land. It's a process. It's a process of accepting a new way of life, which is servitude, which means submitting ourselves to the Torah and to the will of God, and to accepting upon ourselves this yoke. But through that process, we begin embarking on a journey which ends up empowering us with freedom. That's what it means. It's the time of our freedom. It's not the time when we became free now because we're released from bondage. It's the time that we were offered a path that would lead to freedom. In degree. It's not all or nothing. The more you study, the more you practice, the more you accept that yoke, the freer you become. It is kind of like a paradox, but it's a wonderful paradox. The paradox is that the more you serve, the more you accept upon the yoke, the freer you become. That's the answer. And that's why, by the way, that's why Pesach is absolutely tied to Shavuos. You know, we're in the period called the Omer. We're counting. Why do we count? The day after we leave Egypt, counting. Day 1, day 2, day 3, all the way up to day 49. And the next day, we receive the Torah. What does that have to do with Pesach? Because the freedom comes with growing and becoming more and more accepting of God's yoke, to the point where we are ready to accept the commandments. So the freedom just is just the beginning. Pesach is just the beginning of that process. But you got to have Shavuos, because that's where we get the instructions. That's where we get the Torah that really, really empowers us. Before Shavuos, we were just getting ready to accept the Torah. We were finding out how God works. We were learning about having faith in Him, you know, amid all the trials and tribulations that we had in the desert. It's all part of the process. Okay. We got to come back to the Parsha. The quality which we were currently studying, and we didn't have much time because of our break, was Precious. Precious is, we had one class on it. Precious is separation, or you could call it abstinence. And Rabbi Luzzatto says it is the beginning of the level called Hasidus piety, because it is in the realm of going beyond the obligations of the Torah. Piety is the second half of godly service, where we even go beyond. And we spoke about the concept of going beyond. I won't repeat that. But on the level of Precious, a person is able to say, I know that the food is kosher, and of course I won't eat non-kosher food, but I don't have to be a glutton. I don't have to engorge myself with food. I don't have to be a hedonist when it comes to food. I don't have to eat at every, you know, at a different kosher restaurant every night. I can abstain and eat moderately. And the same thing is true. I'm referring to chapter 13. Food and drink, on page 94, when free of all dietary prohibitions, are permitted. However, filling the stomach leads one to rebelliousness against heaven. It leads to addiction, and addiction leads to, to negative behaviors. And so, Precious is a good thing. The ability to abstain, even from that which is permitted by the mitzvah, is a quality which keeps a person healthy and away from falling into the patterns of sin. And not only food, but even in let's be honest, this is a very high level, and it's not expected of people to say I'm a poresh, I abstain from things. That's not what is expected of us. Most people are still trying to keep the laws, and that's fine. But there is a higher level. He speaks about the marital relationship. He says that the rabbis try to encourage a couple to, of course, enjoy marital intimacy, but to do so with moderation. That's where they got the there's a practice. It's not law, but some men go to the mikveh. You know, men don't have to go to the mikveh. Women have to go to the mikveh. Men don't. But they said men should go to the mikveh too. Why? It was a way of keeping people in moderation, because those mikvehs were pretty cold, and people didn't like to. So a man would have to go every time he had marital relations. He would have to go to the mikveh before he could go into shul. Anyway, he talks about that. A person could be keeping the law, he's not having an illicit relationship, but still he indulges more than he should. And also another example, clothing and ornaments. See where I'm going here? Amazing. The Torah made no prohibitions regarding the style or beauty of clothing. It said that it should not contain forbidden mixture of wool and linen. It said that the men have to wear the tzitzit. But that's it. There's no prohibition against style. However, it is a known thing that if a person wears only the fanciest, most ornamental garments, that leads to arrogance. It causes other people to be jealous. It causes him to look down on people. So being overindulgent in clothing is, while you're not violating any mitzvah, you are still not leading in a good path. And a person should abstain, moderate in the area of clothing as well. And I can't think of another area where a person can actually abstain or draw guidelines for himself without any commandment, thou shalt not. But a person on his own says, it's good to be moderate. It's good to abstain from too much eating. It's good to abstain from too much sexual activity. It's good to abstain from too much opulence. And, you know, he doesn't say the house, but nowadays, isn't that the object of our status, is our house? And how could I have, I mean, you know, I look around some of the big houses out there in some of those neighborhoods, and I say, there's probably only two people living in that house. In the meantime, we have, Kanai Nahara, a house full. Couldn't they give us a few of their rooms? Couldn't we use it better than they can? And yet, no, they have to have the six bedrooms and the who knows what. That leads to a totally different value system. And it calls, and the Torah calls upon, or a development of these qualities calls upon a person to exercise moderation. And that's total freedom. Because there's no mitzvah. There's nobody telling you what to do. There's no mitzvah that says your house has to be X number of square feet. There's no mitzvah that says your suits should cost, you know, cost under, you know, $375. There's no mitzvah. There's no mitzvah that says how many kosher restaurants you're allowed to eat in. This is not in the realm of mitzvah. It's totally in the realm of freedom. Only a free person who can actually think and decide how he wants to lead his house, would do his life, would do such a thing. So I like to see that precious is synonymous with freedom. The ability to actually be judicious and decide how much to indulge, how much, requires total freedom. And that's what Torah is teaching us, how to become the masters of our own lives and the masters of our own direction. And that's what I believe, coming back to the Parsha, perhaps the Torah is telling us. God gave us, blessed us with a body, with a life. God blessed us with means to clothe ourselves, to house ourselves, and he didn't set rules. He didn't set rules. You know, some of us are limited by, you know, with financial constraints, but by and large, God did not set rules, and he gives us freedom. And he says, "Here's the world. Use the world as you see fit." But if a person abuses, if a person overindulges, whether it's through his body in pleasures, whether eating or whatever, whether if a person abuses his clothing, or if a person abuses his home and doesn't practice precious, that's when the tzara'at come, the afflictions come, and they say to a person, Are you thinking enough? Are you making a decision whether this is the right measure for indulgence? Maybe you're not abstinent enough with your body. Maybe you're not abstinent enough with your clothing or with your house. Think about it again. It's a sign from God, where an area that's not bound by law, it's a sign from God to rethink it and to remember that we have freedom, we have been granted freedom to choose, even in areas that are not bound by law, to choose the right measure. And that is the freedom that we were granted with Torah. It's a developmental process, But that is what we are celebrating, and we will continue to celebrate as we become closer and closer to embracing the Torah, which gives us that power.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.